Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Taplin, author of The End of Reality, How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his latest book, The End of Reality, How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto, Jonathan Taplin provides insight into the personal backgrounds and cultural power of four billionaires, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Marc Andreessen. They are hyping schemes that are designed to divert our attention away from issues that really matter. Jonathan Taplin is a public intellectual, writer, film producer, and scholar. He is the director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California and a professor at the USC Annenberg School. His career has included acting as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the Band and producing major films such as Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets. His previous books include the instant classic Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Jonathan Taplin, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be here, Bob.
Jonathan, let's start at the very beginning, which makes a lot of sense. Your book about four billionaires, you call them technocrats, and you use the term techno-determinism to describe the path they've dictated for America. What's that path, and why is it so different from what you and I and many others think ought to be our path?
Well, in the Clinton administration, as the internet was just being kind of formed, you know, Al Gore called it the information superhighway.
Right.
They decided that, and this was with Newt Gingrich's very strong encouragement, that these new networks, Google, at that point, Facebook wasn't really there, but would come soon. And obviously Twitter and everyone else came after this, would have a special, what they called safe harbor dispensation. In other words, a liability shield so that you could never sue them for anything that was on their networks. In other words, it was not their problem. It was the fact that a user had posted something, whether it was a lie or whether it was a piece of copyrighted material that they didn't own or whatever. But what that did was allow a kind of unregulated nature to the internet. And so from that point on, the people who ended up dominating that, and I will tell you that the early pioneers of the internet thought it would be a very democratizing, decentralizing thing, but it didn't turn out that way. And as we all know, you know, Google controls 90% of the search traffic, and Facebook and Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, controls most of the social networks, and what they don't control, Twitter or X controls. So it's really under the sway of very few people, and all of the people in my story, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Marc Andreessen, and Peter Thiel, are part of that control group. Thiel and Andreessen were the two earliest investors in Facebook, and obviously Musk controls X, and Zuckerberg obviously is the CEO of the Facebook group. So the problem is that they have a plan for the world, and it's not something that any of us ever got a chance to vote on or anything. And, you know, if you look at charts of things like teenage self-harm, it all goes along very flat for many years. And then all of a sudden in 2011, it just takes off like a rocket. And that's suicide and all sorts of other problems, especially for women. And it's really, everyone thinks that it's because of social networks. And so the notion of techno-determinism is they're determining our future and we don't have a vote in it. And of course, as AI becomes more and more a prominent part of our life, that will also be something that we're going to have to deal with.
Well, that's one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading your book is where are the people that are going to put the brakes on, who in Congress is going to put the brakes on. But again, I know I'm getting a little ahead of myself because I was going to ask you about safe harbor later on in our interview. But since you mentioned it, would the place to start be the repeal of the Safe Harbor Act and get these four and their companies back into the kind of regulation that governs every other part of the so-called private sector?
Yeah, it would. I mean, let's just take the incident of the 2020 election. So there was a tremendous amount of misinformation and lies about the voting machine companies, Smartmatic, and Rupert Murdoch ended up having to pay a $780 million fine for putting forth lies about these companies. There were far more of that content on Twitter and Facebook, but neither of them had to pay anything because you can't sue them. And so my feeling is that, you know, there's something about having to pay $780 million that kind of focuses the mind and makes you be a little more responsible as a citizen. And so Murdoch, needless to say, took off all the lies about that and apologized and everything. But Facebook and Twitter never had to do that. And there continues. I mean, Elon Musk wrote to his 140 million followers, "I just found out that all these illegal aliens are going to be able to vote. I didn't know that." Well, that's totally untrue. But these people who follow him believe he's the genius of the world, and they believe everything he says. You know, so this is really problematic.
Let's talk about another one of these technocrats. I do want to get into the four projects and have you briefly describe each of those. But before we do that, the one technocrat that I think folks know the least about, and I could be wrong on this, is Peter Thiel. The other names are bandied about daily in the press. But Thiel, of course, lots of us know him, but he's described by one writer, you quote the writer, as saying the most clearly fascist prominent figure in the U.S. today. You call him the most influential. Share your thoughts on Thiel and how he works over these other guys, I guess you could say.
Well, Thiel was the co-founder with Musk of PayPal, and he made his fortune when they sold PayPal to eBay for $1 billion+. He has said very clearly that democracy and capitalism are incompatible. And of course, he's on the side of capitalism and not democracy. So his favorite person is Marcus Moldbug, who basically thinks that what we need is a monarchy. And so if you think about a lot of the thinking that's going into coming from the Claremont Institute and other things, is a kind of new authoritarianism that will deal with things that they feel is there's lots of disorder in America, in the cities, at the border, all of this. And what we really need is a strong man. And of course, Trump is putting himself forth as that person. So Thiel has got a few other odd ideas. He wants to live to the age of 200. So he has a lab called Methuselah Lab, in which they test with mice. And turns out that the old mice that get blood transfusions from very young mice live longer than the old mice that don't get blood transfusions. So Peter has taken that, and he goes down to a lab in San Diego once a month and gets blood transfusions from 15-year-olds. Now, just in case that doesn't work, he's also contracted with one of the companies that will freeze your body. And then, you know, essentially, if they solve whatever disease that they have that killed you, they can unfreeze you and bring you back to life. This is a kind of Frankenstein.
I guess.
But this informs a lot of what he believes in, which is the notion of transhumanism, which is this idea that at some point in the very near future, there will be this point called the singularity where humans and computers merge. And you essentially, Bob, you could upload your consciousness to a computer and continue to do this radio show for the next 75 years if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, part of this kind of fantasy world that these people live in. You know, it's no wilder than Elon Musk saying the Earth is doomed and we've all got to go to Mars. Now, obviously, Mars has no oxygen. Mars has no minerals of any sort that we could use to do anything with. And I think his reason for wanting Mars was he read Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles when he was a kid and just kind of fixated on that. The fact that it would cost about $20 trillion to establish a small colony of 100 people on Mars, and that would be your money and my money. That would be the taxpayers' money that would pay for this fantasy. And of course, Elon would make a nice 30% margin on that $20 trillion, you know, so that another add to his world-class wealth. But you'd get up there and you'd have to live in a bubble. You couldn't go outside. The radiation is too strong. It would give you cancer in 5 minutes. So it's pretty crazy.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, author of The End of Reality, How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. Could you give us an idea of just how much money in federal funding goes from the Department of Defense, NASA, Homeland Security, and CIA into the pockets of people like Elon Musk and the others who are building something that we've had absolutely no control over?
Well, you know, Musk is not alone in picking the federal pocket.
Of course, yeah, right.
So he figured out early on that even in recessions, nobody ever cuts the defense budget. So here's the deal. They all claim to be libertarians, all four of them, but they're not. They're the ultimate kind of crony capitalists. So Musk's SpaceX is totally financed by NASA. So every single flight he does, he gets a 20% markup on what it costs for him to launch a rocket. And NASA pays the freight. Musk's satellite company provides, for instance, satellite service for many, many governments, but it's all paid for by governments. The U.S. Defense Department pays for the Ukrainian army's use of Musk's satellites. Musk's car company, Tesla, gets subsidies. I mean, first off, in 2008, Obama arranged for Musk to get a subsidy of about $300 million. And this was at a point when Tesla was teetering. And now, when you buy a Tesla, the government will pay $15,000 towards you getting an electric vehicle. You know, so he's got subsidies everywhere. But Andreessen said, well, gee, this is quite a racket. So now Andreessen is in, if your listeners don't know, Mark Andreessen is the most important venture capitalist in America. And one of his companies is in the business of making what are called autonomous weapons. Some people call them killer robots. But Anduril, his company, makes both robots that roll along on the ground carrying an M16 and drones. And unlike the drones that we use, had used in Afghanistan and Iraq, these are drones in which the artificial intelligence on board makes the decision to pull the trigger. Now, this in testing has had a few problems because the killer robots sometimes have a very hard time at 150 yards telling the difference between a man with a rifle and a man with a broom, and don't seem to make the distinction between the two and pull the trigger. The use of autonomous drones to me seems equally problematic. And most of the countries in the world have tried to ban these at the UN. And of course, the United States and Russia have vetoed this ban proposal, and because we have that power at the UN. And so we're the two countries that want to build these autonomous weapons. Peter Thiel's company, Palantir, got its original venture financing from the CIA, and it is the ultimate surveillance capitalism company. In other words, they basically take all the data they get from any source they can find, whether it's your license data from the Department of Motor Vehicles, whether it's comparing your license plate to your license, all these other pieces of information that they constantly take in. And ostensibly, they were set up to try and find terrorists. Now they're basically used for a kind of minority report kind of policing, where essentially they try and guess who's going to make do the crime before the crime happens. It hasn't worked out too well, and a lot of police departments like Los Angeles have stopped using the software, but he seems to be able to find governments all over the world that are really interested in spying on their citizens, and he provides the tools to do that. Zuckerberg has not gotten into the government business yet, but I'm sure he's looking for ways to do it with, maybe train people, soldiers in the metaverse, which is, of course, his fantasy, which is that you're going to be so bored in the future because AI will do all the work that you're going to want to spend a lot of time with a virtual reality helmet on your head.
Well, and that's brings up the virtual mall. First of all, I cannot imagine having one of these helmets on my head all day, number one. But number two, it seems to raise the question of, to what extent are we going to be willing as a people to invest in the natural world if we've left it and spend all of our days in some fantasy world? I personally don't think this is going to happen in the general population. It may happen with some young people, but say it happens and somehow it would happen. That just seems like the craziest scheme of all.
Well, I think you raised the most important question. What does it mean to be human? And from their point of view, that is not an issue because you're not going to be a human. You're going to be some kind of cyborg 50 years from now. So, let's imagine that Sam Altman, who was the CEO of OpenAI, is right. And Altman says that the marginal cost of intelligence will fall very close to zero within the next 10 years because of artificial intelligence. That means that millions of white-collar, middle-class jobs are going to be eliminated. I have a friend who ran the largest public relations agency in Los Angeles for many years. He's retired now. But at the height of his success, he had about 120 employees. And about 90 of them made content. That is, they created press releases. They thought up stunts that their clients could do, whatever. And he says if he had to start all over again now, he would have five people who were salespeople and a big AI, ChatGPT, that would create all the press releases, do all that, and then he'd have a couple of editors to, kind of polish the work of the generative AI, and that would be it. So that would be essentially 90 people who were getting paid $120,000, $150,000 a year out of work. Now, a lot of those people were fairly young. They were fresh out of schools like the one I taught at, the University of California, Southern California's Annenberg School for Communications. And they probably had taken a serious amount of student debt in order to do that. So can you imagine you're 3 or 4 years into your work, you've got $100,000 of student debt to pay off, and you're told, oh, sorry, you're fired, you've been replaced by an AI. To my mind, that would be, you know, blood in the streets. You know, that would cause some real pushback, what we used to call a pitchfork brigade. Now, Altman is aware of that, and Altman says, well, we need to have universal basic income. In other words, the government would have to just pay everybody a subsidy to stay home in their pajamas. Now, that's a world I don't think would work. Quite frankly, many of us, and I assume you're one of them, get a lot of meaning out of the work that they do. And if you have no work to do, and obviously Zuckerberg thinks this would be a great deal for the metaverse, right? You'd be home. What were you going to do? Well, you're a fan of Tony Stark and the Avengers. So you become Tony Stark in the metaverse, and you rent Tony Stark's house from Meta, and you rent a date with Gwyneth Paltrow's avatar from Meta, and you give them all this money so that you can live all day in a fantasy universe. And Zuckerberg's business plan is that you will spend 8 hours a day with this helmet on, you know? So, and personally, I think it's crazy. And quite honestly, it's not working out quite well. You notice that he's now talking much more about Meta as an AI company than as a metaverse company. Because if you go on their world, New Horizons, you know, it's like a ghost town. Nobody's there. And I think, you know, there's a lot of questions about, and obviously that's the reason for the title, because these people think that reality has no real meaning. And so you can have fantasy currency like Dogecoin crypto, or you can have fantasy life, oh, I'm going to live on Mars, or you can have fantasy life, oh, I'm going to live in the metaverse, none of which I believe are going to work out.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Jonathan Taplin, author of The End of Reality, How 4 Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. Elaborate on this fantasy culture. You just mentioned Tony Stark, and it reminds me of a section in your book where you talk about the rise of the anti-hero and how that fits in with these autocratic schemes we now find in our politics. And you quote something about the Proteus effect.
Yeah. Well, look, you and I don't know how old you are, but I, from looking at you, I think you're probably my age. You know, we were lucky enough to have lived in a very vital culture in the 60s. We experienced the Beatles when they first arrived and the Rolling Stones, and we experienced the great movies of that era. And so we lived in a very kind of positive and open culture. And something happened, and I don't know if it was 9/11 or what happened, but sometime after 2001, 2002, maybe it was the Iraq War and the discovery that everybody had been lied to about the weapons of mass destruction. But the culture began to turn into a very nihilistic culture. So you think about the TV shows that have been successful since 2001. So The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or Mad Men or White Lotus, it just continues. And they're all about bad, dark people, which we used to call anti-heroes, you know, gangsters, whatever, fighting other ambitious, bad people for power. And my theory is that if you, from the year 2001 to 2015, that was basically your television diet, and you came out with the notion that the bad guy always wins, then it's not that weird that someone would say, well, maybe Tony Soprano should be president, or someone like Tony Soprano. We just need a big ass kicker to run our country, just like, you know, you run a mob family. And that, of course, is what we got. And we may get it again in 2024.
That sums it up all right. Could you give any advice to parents who are listening to this, knowing full well that their children are buying into the programs of these four billionaires? What do you tell somebody?
Okay, so I have like two pieces of advice, one of which is at dinner time, everyone takes their smartphone and puts it in a box and maybe connects the charger up to it, but doesn't touch it from that point on. In other words, you don't allow kids to take their smartphone into their room at night. You don't, because all the evidence is that all the bullying, all that stuff goes on after 7 o'clock at night. It's when people are in their rooms texting each other that all this bad stuff happens. And so you do that. And then the second thing is that as a family, and you want to try and set an example, you take what people are calling a digital Sabbath. In other words, you take one day a week, whether it's Sunday or Saturday, whatever, what day you choose, and everyone takes the whole day and does not use their smartphones or their computers. In other words, you do not go on the internet for a day. And you read real books, you read real newspapers, you have real conversations, and you can watch a sports match on TV, but you don't indulge in the doom scrolling on the internet, which is what really is what making people crazy and disaffected. And it's very clear to me that society just changed radically once social media became part of it. It I don't want to be one of those people to say in my day, but it used to be that we had a shared set of facts. The end of his broadcast every night, Walter Cronkite would say, that's the way it is, June 18th, 1982, right?
Right.
And in general, people would have agreed in that. No matter whether they were Republicans or Democrats, they basically had a shared set of facts. We no longer have that. There is nobody that has a shared set of facts. There's a Twitter set of facts or X set of facts, which have no relationship with the set of facts that's in the New York Times or the Washington Post or some legitimate newspaper that's actually fact-checked. And without a shared set of facts, there's no way that we're going to get any kind of consensus.
No doubt. Now, there is some hope here, and you offer it to your readers. You tell us about the work of John Fullerton at the Capital Institute, and you talk about regenerative economics and the cooperative network playing a role in innovations at the firm. Please share that with us.
Yeah. So in general, you know, I ran an innovation lab at USC for 12 years. And if there was one thing I learned, which was that great organizations push power out to the edges of the organization. One of the people on my board was a guy named Irving Ladowski Berger, who ran IBM's internet division. And in the early days of the internet, IBM internally fought the internet like crazy. IBM was a mainframe company, and they thought that the internet and the personal computer and all of that was going to just decimate their business. And Sam Palmisano, who was CEO of IBM, said to Irving, we need to lower the center of gravity at this company. And what he meant by that was that he needed to be able to empower people who ran a division in India, or ran a division in Singapore, or ran a division in Germany, and have them not have to check back with central headquarters on everything. And so essentially, a lot of what I believe in is that we need to get back to a more local way of thinking. And so John Fullerton's work is all about how we don't live in an extractive economy. In other words, an economy that's just based on digging up the earth and destroying the natural capital of the world in order to make some money in the near term. And so if you think about it, AI and crypto are just extractive economies. They both take gigantic amount of electricity to run those servers. And they're both incredibly wasteful in that terms. And what the productivity gains of AI for that waste is up in the air at this point. So what you really need is companies that begin to think about doing things differently. So you just take like the Levi's company. One of their big initiatives is you can bring your jeans in and they will recycle. They will reuse the materials. Patagonia is another company that totally does that. You bring in that old, you know, fuzzy that you've been wearing for years, and they'll remake new ones out of that material. Pepsi-Cola is trying to do regenerative farming. And, you know, obviously the amount of corn in Fritos is a lot, you know? So they have to think about how are they using water? How are they using all these things? And so as companies get more conscious of that and aren't just using all the natural resources of our country without putting anything back, it is very hopeful. But I'm also hopeful in that I think that people are beginning to feel a little skeptical that the internet is not necessarily the solution. And I think one of the things I've noticed is that the artistic community is strongly pushing back against AI. So for instance, here in Hollywood, where, you know, I worked for many years as a film producer, there were two labor strikes this year from both the actors and the writers. And those strikes were primarily about artificial intelligence. The companies like Marvel wanted to take every screenplay they'd ever written and put it into a large learning model. And then they, instead of hiring a screenwriter for a lot of money to write a first draft for a new Captain America movie, they would hire a prompt writer, some jabron who would write four paragraphs. You know, here's the first act, here's the second act, here's the third act. And then in an hour or two, the machine would spit out a first draft screenplay. And then, of course, they couldn't copyright the screenplay because the copyright office won't let you copyright something made by a machine. So they'd hire some poor out of work screenwriter to do a little polish and put his name on it, and then they'd get a copyright. And that would be the new world. So basically the Writers Guild said no to that. And the Actors Guild did the same thing. They said, you know, what the studios wanted was be able to have somebody come into a studio and get their body scanned 360 in a green screen suit and essentially for a one-time payment own their body. And so they could put them, insert them into any scene, put any clothes on them, any period, put different hair cuts on them, whatever, and just own their body. So you know, there would be no more extras. And of course, as you know, the only way to get into the Screen and Actors Guild is you're an extra, and the director is kind enough to give you one line. And if you get one line, then you can get in the Screen Actors Guild. So, and again, the actors fought that and stopped it. And the same thing is happening in the music business. These companies like TikTok, they're flooding the airwaves with lots of music made by AI. Well, how did the AI make that music? That is because these tools have taken every piece of music that's ever been done by any artist without permission, put into the model. And then if you say, write me something that sounds like Bob Dylan from 1965, it'll do it. And you will get something that kind of sounds like Bob Dylan, and the lyrics are pretty banal, but it can do it. And that's going to change the livelihoods of every musician in the world. And that's not a good thing.
Jonathan, we've run out of time, but I can't thank you enough for writing this book. Again, the full title, and we didn't begin to cover everything in your treatment of this subject, and I urge our listeners to get out and get a copy. It's The End of Reality: How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. Jonathan Taplin is the author. He's been our guest today at Reader's Corner. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.